Good afternoon. In the words of Al Haig, I'm in control here. Senator Wagner is delayed in a meeting with Senator Stevens in Ledge Council, and I think Ralph, Representative Samuels is on his way over here after he's working on an appointment for I think the Victims' Rights Council. So I am delighted to be joined for this meeting by our friend Senator Stedman, Representative Elkins, Representative Olson, Representative Crawford, Representative Seaton, and Senator Wagner will be here shortly. We're going to do an overview of DNR, and Commissioner Menge, I'm going to let you do the whole show. We are, you are, I'd just like to say on the record what a fine man you are, and I just think you're going to be a great commissioner in DNR. You're a good man. We're all pleased, I think, to be working with you, and we'd be delighted if you would introduce all the new members of DNR, since there's such a change at the top of the organization.
Thank you, Representative Ramers. Get my notes together here. For the record, my name is Mike Menge. I'm the Commissioner Designate for the Department of Natural Resources, and I really appreciate the opportunity to visit with you this afternoon and walk through the moving parts of the Department of Natural Resources. It's an agency that I've had the pleasure of working closely with over the last 25 years, only most recently, of course, associated with it directly. But my relationship with DNR stretches back to my first years here in Alaska with various federal and state agencies, and I think it underscores the influence the DNR has over the entire state. And thank you for that kind introduction, and I will take a moment to introduce the people that are with me. They are the cream. They have risen to the top in the organization, and I have known most of them for many years and have come to have a great deal of trust and take their words to heart, and they assist in guiding me through the channel with DNR. And as you know, there are occasional rocks and snags along our path, and these folks have spent most of their careers assisting and trying to avoid those and serve the people of Alaska. I think the first one, Deputy Commissioner Ken Griffin right now has taken my place in the gas negotiations and should be here shortly as soon as we finish up.
Oh, he's here.
All right, he's finished up. I'd like to introduce Ken. He is the takes care of the oil and gas side of DNR as my deputy commissioner. The other deputy commissioner is Ed Fogles. Ed handles all of the other issues other than oil and gas for the department. He is assisted, and all of us are assisted, by Rachel Petro, my special assistant. And then we have a number of the directors here. This was a golden opportunity for us to spend a lot of quality time with the members, and also there are a number of organizations in town meetings, so we're lucky today to have these folks here in person. And once my presentation is completed, we stand ready to bore down into any issue that is of concern to you, and we'll take it all the way to bedrock if that is your inclination. Bill Van Dyke, thank you, Bill, is a director of the Division of Oil and Gas. Carrie Howard is the director of the Office of Habitat Management and Permitting. Chris Mache is my director of forestry. Jerry Lewinsky, director of the Division of Parks. Dick Milius, director of Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Nico, my good right arm, is the director of Support Services. And last but certainly not least is Randy Bates, our director of Office Project Management and Permitting. Each of these people are longtime career DNR employees, and as I said, have achieved the positions that they're in now through their efforts. I want to take an opportunity to really thank you for this chance to visit with you. I think everyone that comes to this chair says that, and as a staffer over the years, I've sometimes wondered the sincerity what they've had to say, but believe me, in this case, I really appreciate it. My 7 years as a staffer on the U.S. Senate Energy Committee taught me the value of the relationship between the executive and the legislative branch. So I've had a chance to look at the world in fairly close detail from both sides. And each of us plays a unique and very important role in government. It's our job to propose, and your job to approve and provide the budget. And you also provide another very important function, and that's oversight. We at DNR take our responsibilities very seriously, and in so doing, recognize your responsibilities and stand ready to assist you at any time. We don't stand on formality at DNR. If you have an issue or there's something that you want to bore down into, we will provide the staff and the background necessary to do it, because you do play a very important role. And so the legislative and the executive have to work together, and under my watch, that will occur. The one thing I do not tolerate is lack of accountability. These are difficult times that we're in, challenging times that we're in, and each of us has to be prepared to stand up and say what we mean, do what we say, and then stand accountable for the actions that we take. And if I find that that's not occurring in my department, then we will take steps to correct that. One of the things about an overview on the Department of Natural Resources, it's a daunting experience, because as I said earlier, this department really stretches across the entire breadth of the state. It's at the forefront of the governor's initiatives of developing natural resources and putting them to work for the betterment of Alaska, current and future generations. We have a responsibility to carry out the governor's initiatives, but we really are the business arm, at least I like to think of us as the business arm of the state government. We have the privilege of being the guardians of the resources, and we take great pride in doing that. We recognize that Alaska is in competition with the rest of the world. And while it's one thing to say that our natural resources are our future and the fuel that fires our economy, it's another thing to actually put that into practice. You simply cannot, in this day and age of global economics, place a commodity on the table and say, here it is, here are our terms, come and get it. You have got to compete on a world market for these resources. And in so competing, you must never forget that your ultimate responsibility are to the people of the state of Alaska. So you have a dual responsibility. You must aggressively market, but you also must aggressively protect the resource owners, the people of the state. DNR takes it very seriously, and it probably is the crux of what we do, finding a way to maximize the benefit of the resource to the betterment of the people of Alaska. We try and succeed most of the time. There are times we trip and stumble, and when that's the case, we'll simply pick ourselves up, figure out what went wrong, and continue on from there. But this, we cannot, the only sin would be to fail to try. And we will try, we will work whatever issue it is that we have to deal with until we finally seek a resolution to that.
Commissioner, let me just interrupt you for a moment just to recognize that Representative Kelly and Representative Newman have joined us. Thank you.
One of the things, I grew up on a ranch. My father was a philosopher, if you will, and he was well rooted in reality. And one of the things that he always taught me was that talk was cheap, and that really a man is, or an agency, is not measured by what they say, but what they do. Part of the way we account for our behaviors through our missions and measures. The things that we say we're going to do, that we go ahead and do them, and then we measure that. It's a very important component in government, and one that is easy to say and very difficult to do. It's very difficult to measure a long, labored meeting with a group of constituents or a group of industry representatives that at the end of the day really doesn't result in anything other than hopefully a better understanding of the positions that you're in. So a lot of what we do defies measurement. And the truth is, the only way you can really figure out if you've been successful is at the end of the day, or the end of the week, or the end of the year, whether you've accomplished what you've set out to do. We have a list of things that we try to use as guidelines, if you will, beacons in the night, that help carry us through our mission. We need to encourage resource development and do that across the entire state. We're not, the North Slope obviously is our cash register, and a lot of our effort is focused on that. But Alaska's resources stretch across the entire state, and they affect all of the peoples in the state of Alaska. We cannot afford to simply go to the place that generates the most funds for the state treasury and ignore the rest of the state. That would be a bad thing to do. So one of the things we do in this department is try to search out, working with the communities, an opportunity to develop the resources across the state. One of the things that I take great pride in is looking at areas that are underdeveloped and working diligently to try to bring resource development to that area. In bringing it to the area, people need to be ready for it. So it's not our job to shove things down people's throats. It's our jobs to work with the locals, communities, and with the companies that are interested and try to form a relationship, a long-lasting relationship. I would probably point to the Red Dog as one of the areas that we've been most successful in bringing an industry to a region and watching that industry and the region grow together with an economic base and an opportunity for everyone to partake in that. It's very important that that model or similar models like it be implanted across the state. So we in DNR are looking and will continue to search for opportunities to create business in places that are off the beaten path. I think one other example of our most recent attempts in that area is on the onshore Bristol Bay oil and gas sale. That's an area of the state that depends on fishing and fishing alone. It's nice to have a little bit of diversity, and we believe that the oil and gas sale will start bringing some folks in. So that's just one example. We ensure resource development through a process of planning, management, and an application of on-the-ground science. There's no place for, I guess it's hard to separate emotions, but we have to set emotions to the side and let good science dictate the actions that we take. Something cannot be simply because we just want it to be. It has to be because there's a good reason for it, that the science, the technology is there. And that's a big part of what we do. Another thing is sustainability. Sustainability seems like an interesting topic for a state with Alaska that has the untold resources that we do. But frankly, our fishing industry and our timber industry have taught us the values of sustainability. So part of what we do in our resource development is really keep an eye toward future generations and opportunities that will be available to them. So we really take sustainability to heart. And I think you'll see that through our permitting primarily, so that as we allow activities to take place, they take place in a manner that leaves the lightest touch possible upon the land, which is my personal view of sustainability, is to be able to come, do what you need to do, go, and then people wonder if you were ever there to begin with. That's a real mark of success. We manage these resources through sales and through leases, permitting. All of these activities have to be very closely managed. They're the tools that we use to fire the engine of the economy. And there are ones that are sideboarded with a lot of regulation, a lot of statute. And as I've told people, each regulation and each statute exists for a specific reason. It just wasn't thought up out of the clear blue sky. It was either in response to a need, It may have been in response to someone who was taking advantage of a situation. In any event, each one of these things is there for a reason. And our job is to take these, and sometimes they do get cumbersome, sometimes they overlap over years, and it's our job to chart a course through the regulations and the statutes to bring about success, honoring them. And if they don't work, then we come to you as the legislature and try to explain why something isn't working and why we need to change it, and then assist you if you find merit in that in doing it. It's not our job to ignore statutes and regs. It's not our job to not follow through. So if it ever happens, and I'm not aware of it doing, then we will take quick action. Because we simply, those are the speed limits, those are the rules of the road, the no passing zones. We must honor them. Competition is an interesting thing. As I've been sitting through the gas line negotiations over the last 18 months, I've come to have a deep and abiding appreciation for the world commodity market. I had always thought that I was pretty wise about these issues. And while I was kind of like the Platte River, I was a mile wide and an inch deep. I really didn't have that visceral understanding of how the commodities interplay with each other. Well, thanks to our negotiation, I've come to really appreciate that. And in so doing, I've come to appreciate the role that Alaska plays in the job that we have to do up here, the partnerships that we have to form. Partnership is another one of those words that is often spoken and I think seldom understood. Partners respect and honor each other. They respect the roles and responsibilities. They appreciate the benefits that come from working together. But partners do not take advantage of each other. Partners do not try to intimidate or bully their partners. That's not a partnership. Alaska has a role and a responsibility as a partner to the resource companies, to any of the special interest groups, and to the people that come to our door seeking a chance to get a permit or to put in place a business or simply to build a driveway. So the partnership starts in DNR at our heart, look to develop these partnerships. And I'll talk in a little bit about some of the methods that we use to do that. But underlying all of the rhetoric, underlying all of the things that we see is a rock solid foundation of partnership in its truest sense. And we will do everything we can to foster partnerships. But we're also not so naive as to think that this is a perfect world. And sometimes partners try to get into your wallet a little bit, and sometimes partners take you for advantage. And at that point, you have a responsibility to point that out to them. So we will doggedly protect our responsibility, but we're going to do that in a way that fosters the partnership, if our partners will allow it. Sometimes it just simply can't be, and at that point we have to be smart enough to recognize when there's an incompatibility and then just simply back away from that. Before I get into a long litany, I will spare you the agonizing detail of crawling through every section in the DNR. I do want to talk about some of our really big issues. Obviously, the oil and gas issues really drive our cash register, and a tremendous amount of effort is now going on into the gas line. One of the interesting synergisms that people are only now beginning to recognize is that, as we all know, TAPS was robust and pumped over 2 million barrels of oil a day. And during those heady days in the late 70s, early 80s, it seemed like it would last forever. But during my hiatus to the U.S. Senate, the 7 years I was gone, that resource has dwindled down to less than 1 million barrels per day. There's a synergism with the gas line that's going to allow us to put more oil in the pipeline. Now, why is that? In Alaska, if you are a geologist and you discovered a gas well, as the governor is fond of saying, you couldn't even get anybody to buy you a beer. It really was a waste product. There's a concept known as a minimum economic field size. So as you stepped out from Prudhoe Bay as you drilled holes, you would find oil and gas. If you didn't find enough oil to a standalone prospect, that was simply shut down and written off as a non-discovery. And if we bring the gas line online, the fact that there will be both oil and gas in there will allow us to develop the oil by virtue of the gas that's there. So there's a real synergism in that that I think it's real important to understand. I want to talk a little bit about our major initiatives. As I talked about, it's all based on a partnership approach.
Commissioner, let me, I just want to, my friend here got here, Senator Wagner, the chairman of Senate Resources. Go ahead.
Senator. When I was here, in one of my former incarnations, I was the federal head of the TAPS Oversight Office, what we call the, and that office had been put in place during construction, and it worked nice, and it gotten us all the way through construction and production. But one of the things we found out as we were getting ready, when Governor Hickel proposed to build the Trans-Alaska Gas Line, we recognized that government had grown very complex since the days of TAPS. One of the most pleasurable experiences I've had in government is working with then state employee by the name of Jerry Barassi to create the Joint Federal State Pipeline Monitoring Office. That office came together in a unique combination of federal and state agencies, all in one place. The thing that we did that I'm the most proud of is we did not start or try, as most joint organizations do, to seat authority within a single individual. We recognized each agency brought with it its own statutory responsibilities. So when we put that office together, the decision was made to not try to take the regulatory authority away from anybody. Rather, bring them into the same, in one room, put them around a table and work issues and work them off of joint documents and try to develop common documents with which then each agency could then draw the information necessary to execute their regulatory authority. We have taken this program, or this concept is now spread into the state and into DNR. Things have gotten even more complicated since the 80s when we did that. Each agency has a huge amount of responsibility, statutory authority, regulations. And if exercised in a vacuum, it's absolute chaos for someone who's seeking a permit to do anything. Even a simple thing like a driveway permit, if you have the misfortune of living in a low-lying area, will take into consideration a number of state and federal agencies. You can imagine if you have something of a larger magnitude, like a mine or an oil field, the complexity of state and federal regulations is mind-boggling. And in Alaska, there's nothing that we do in Alaska that is not wrapped in a cloak of controversy. Controversy often manifests itself in agencies, state and federal agencies, becoming like deer in the headlight. They get to a position that no matter what they do, it's wrong. And so, rather than take a chance, which they're not being paid to do, they simply go into gridlock. If you have a dozen state and federal agencies, all of which have to work together to accomplish a goal, and they're simply not working together, or they're afraid to act, then what you have is gridlock. So what we have done through our large project management team is to create an environment where agencies come together, and there's a synergism that develops out of groups working together. If you sit around the table with your fellow state and federal regulators and you all agree on a specific document, an EIS, and you do that, then each of you can draw from it. And another thing happens, each of the agencies can lean onto the others so that they're not afraid to take an action. If any agency does something that's inappropriate, there's an administrative appeal, there's the courts, there's remedy for an agency that takes a wrong action. There is no remedy for an agency that refuses to take action. So as we created the large project management team within DNR, the theory behind that was that the people, they come, they bring their authority, they work together. If one of them has a problem, we all have a problem. And we work through, and I think we had some remarkable successes in some of our large projects, particularly Pogo and Kensington, to the extent that we've gotten there. And you'll see that also employed on major expansions in the oil and gas. So the large project management team is really a core element in accomplishing the businesses that we want to put together, the relationships, the partnerships, because this is a way that we can really influence the federal agencies that work with us. You can't tell them what to do, and we're not going to threaten or intimidate, but a remarkable thing happens when a group comes together and agrees on a common purpose. They get great comfort from the participatory process. And that's the real contribution that DNR makes in its large projects. We've brought the Coastal Zone Management Program into here, and Randy Bates is here, and he's up for sainthood, because he took a very controversial project, worked diligently to bring people together and hammer out a solution that was just signed off on in December. And it was a remarkable accomplishment because of the fact that no one believes that something new is better than what is going on now. It takes a lot of confidence to try something new. And Randy and the employees that work for him had a huge job in working with the coastal zone districts, helping them to understand what the new vision would be like and what their roles, authorities would be, and that we were there to assist them in succeeding. We were not there to take from them their ability to protect the issues that are important to them. So the Coastal Zone Program being brought into DNR also now sits or will assist the large projects. So they'll be in the same room. So you're beginning to see this continuity. The Habitat Division from Fish and Game is now in DNR. And so with Habitat, you now have a complete spectrum of responsibilities for protection of resources, for the protection of the communities, and for the establishment of partnerships. So these three organizations working together are able to provide a forum for those who have the most contentious projects to deal with. It doesn't mean that everyone is going to be successful. What it means, though, is that there is an opportunity in a group of highly trained professionals dedicated to their success in a way that protects our resources and our responsibilities. I'm not aware of anything in the country that approaches this concept of bringing these organizations together under a single agency focused on success. And it's quite remarkable and something I think all of us in Alaska can be proud of. And the beauty of it is, as I'm beginning to repeat myself, is that there's a pathway to success. If there is a pathway to success, it lies through this kind of an organizational development. But it also means that our resources, our environment, our resources are protected throughout the process. And that's our responsibility. But it's that kind of problem-solving skills, I think, is the trademark of DNR, and has been and will continue under my watch. I'm going to step into the resource now, just kind of a quick punch list. And Senator Wagner, I don't know what your schedule is or whether I can obviously spend days on each of these topics. I'll try to brush them through quickly and make ourselves available for questions, or I can move through them a little slower and it's at your discretion, sir.
It's a divisional overview, so give us the overview.
You got it. Any questions that I can answer, I have my colleagues here to assist me. One of the leaps of faith that have occurred here is the legislature's support and willingness to provide the resources necessary to our Division of Oil and Gas. to build the staff, to build their expertise. This has been a absolute necessity to have the skill levels that we have. We are competing with some of the highest paid and brightest individuals in the world in these multinational corporations. We have a remarkable track record of success in head-on competition with these organizations. As I said, partnership was our standard. Sometimes partners squabble, and sometimes those debates end up in the courts. When that happens, you must be able to defend every action you've taken and support each decision that you've made. Our Division of Oil and Gas has a remarkable track record in being able to back up their contentions, defend them, and be successful, as the courts have indicated. We were able to certainly bring an additional $22 million to the state coffer through our having won the Exxon reopener phase one. There's additional monies that will become available to us in that area. We're now into phase two, and we're going toe to toe with them, and I have every reason to believe that we will be successful. These successes are based on the quality of the individuals working them. There is no place in the court system for leniency because somebody has good intentions. You've got to back up everything you say. And our ability to do that springs directly from the legislature's willingness to support the budget, to allow us to put in place and bring on board the individuals of rare and exceptional quality that we have. One of the interesting things that's happening in the oil and gas business is that in the good old days, it didn't take a lot of people to manage. We had two or three major oil fields, and they were contributing a huge amount of resource and required a relatively small amount of oversight. As we now move westward, southward, and eastward out of Prudhoe Bay, we're finding, as you would imagine, the smaller reserves. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to manage a small resource, as it does more so than a large one, because in the smaller ones, they're on the margin of being economically viable, and there are every issue that comes up has to be dealt with. It's a make it or break it, a live or die issue. There's a lot of passion associated with that. So the decisions that we make have a much more profound effect on these companies' ability to garner the resource, the profit that they believe that they should have. Like when we built TAPS, if we had a problem with TAPS under construction, we simply backed up a dump truck full of money and buried the problem alive in money because there was that kind of robust resource. To a lesser extent, Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, they were just so robust and generated so much cash flow that problems could be worked through. But as we move out into the much smaller resources, this is not the case. We cannot bury problems in money. We have to think our way through and we have to resolve them in the most efficient way possible. To do that and to protect the resource and the state's resources, we have to really get down into the detail and evaluate the situations that are confronted by us. And they will be defended passionately by the individuals that we're working with. There's not a, oh, well, that's just fine. Whatever you want, if you want a bridge there, we'll just build it. Now it's, oh, my God, that bridge is going to cost $2.8 million. Why can't we use three small culverts? And we get into that kind of a debate, trying to strike a balance between what it takes to protect a resource and what it takes to maintain the economic viability of the participants. I won't spend, you guys will have ample time to look at the gas pipeline, so I'm not going to dwell on that today, other than if there are questions later on, we'll certainly go into that. But one of the things I did want to talk about in our oil and gas is our stepping out into a new basin and opening our lease sale with in Bristol Bay and with Shell's participation there. It'll be wonderful to have a third oil and gas basin in the state of Alaska. There's a thing that happens. Oil basins-like people are young and rambunctious. They grow into middle age, and then they get old and tired. And when that happens, you need to step out and regenerate the resource. That's a big part of what we do, and bringing new explorers to Alaska. It's one of the governor's major initiatives. It's one of the best things that we can do for the state of Alaska. Let me give you an example in the Gulf of Mexico, where early on you had the major companies were responsible for the majority of the production there. As the production began to decline, you saw an evolution of mid-sized companies, smaller companies moving into the Gulf. We're going to see that in Alaska, and we already are seeing it with the presence of Pioneer, Armstrong, Kerr McGee, Anadarko. These smaller mid-sized companies are now coming into the basin. We're not there in the beginning. This is very natural, and it's very healthy. Younger companies are just like younger people. They're more rambunctious. They're less risk-aversive, and that's what it's going to take as we move outward from Prudhoe Bay. It's that kind of vitality. So actions and steps that we can take to encourage these people coming in will be to the betterment of all of us. They will keep oil in the oil line, and with a little bit of luck, they'll be putting gas into our gas line for a generation to come. In last lease sales, we have a participation by two majors and 14 independents and eight individuals, God bless them, willing to put their livelihood in the line and bid on these things. We really, really will do everything we can to encourage that. Now, that does not mean turning our backs, looking the other way, or cutting anybody any slack. But if they're willing to try, we're willing to sit down and work with them and find a way to be successful. I think we had our first royalty relief with Pioneer, the Agouric Field. This is a field that was discovered 20 years ago and has lain dormant for all of these years. Thanks to the legislature, you put some tools in our hands to allow us to work with them and find a way to bring that resource online. Now, they haven't sanctioned the project yet, and we haven't seen our first barrel of oil, but we believe that they will move forward. They certainly are hauling gravel out onto the gravel island, so I think that's a good indication. These are the things that we need to do in the Division of Oil and Gas, is to maintain what we have, prepare for the future, and do everything we can to advocate for the resource while recognizing that it is our major cash contributor and that it has to be, that we're entitled to our fair share.
Excuse me just a minute, Commissioner. I'd like the record to note that we've been joined by Ben Stevens. Senator Ben Stevens, excuse me. Thank you.
Senator. Part and parcel to the Department or the Division of Oil and Gas is responsibilities is with the partnership with the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. These are state lands, first and foremost. One of the things that has plagued us from the very beginning is a lack of guidelines and activities on the North Slope. Back in the 70s, if you can imagine, our season for allowing off-road vehicles for exploration was twice as long as it is today. We've seen dramatic changes in that short period of time. The land is a resource, and it's part of that sustainability that I talked about. First and foremost, we need to protect the land base. And we need to do it in a way that does allow for activities. I'm very, very proud of what the Division of Mining, Land, and Water did with their Tundra Travel. They took an issue, a growing concern, and they applied scientific principles to it. In partnership with the Department of Energy and with Yale University, they did the first comprehensive analysis of what is appropriate snow cover and temperatures to allow off-road travel on the North Slope. This is not without some degree of controversy, but they followed the scientific principles, and they were successful. And they succeeded in expanding the season several weeks on either end. They've added 6 weeks or more to the exploration season. And 6 weeks, it equates to a lot of money. So they were very, very good in partnership with the Division of Oil and Gas in achieving a success that stands up to criticism. If people have a problem with it, we present the information, make the calculations, and draw the conclusions.
Excuse me one more time, Commissioner. Also, we've been joined by Representative Gutenberg. So, welcome to the committee. Please continue.
Mining is one of our many crown jewels. Mining competes on a world market, and the world base metal prices are high. And mining in Alaska couldn't be better. If you're going to go elephant hunting, you have to go to elephant country. And Alaska is virtually untapped. We only have scratched the bare surface of our mineral potential across the state. We've had a remarkable record in enticing and bringing in the junior exploration companies. As I spoke of evolution in oil and gas, there's also an evolution in the mining industry, where the small 2- and 3-person organizations come and look and scratch, and if they find something, they go to the next larger organization that comes in that might be able to afford a drill rig, and so on and so forth till they develop the deposit. This is, as day follows night, this is the way it moves in the mining business. If you go across this country, if I can diverge just a moment, one of the things that broke my heart in working in the U.S. Senate was watching the demise of the mineral industry across the United States. One of the foundational industries that helped us win 2 world wars and secure our place in history was just simply being ignored and being ridden out of existence through people who no longer saw a place for mining. And the saying that I learned in Washington, D.C. goes something like this: the facts, while interesting, are wholly irrelevant in this discussion. The fact that mining was able to demonstrate that they could, in fact, put a mine in and do it safely did not make any difference. Mining is drying up on the vine in the lower 48. In the state of Nevada is the only place where there's any viable mining industry left, and it grows is just as getting more and more difficult for them to sustain mining. Alaska, in the United States, Alaska's where you go. We have embraced the mining industry here in a responsible fashion. We invite them into our yard. We offer them the opportunity to be successful. And in return, we expect them to take care of that backyard and to act in a responsible corporate fashion. We've seen successes in Greens Creek, in Red Dog, Fort Knox, and with a little bit of luck here in a couple of weeks, Carl Hahnemann will be pouring his first bar of gold up at Pogo. All of these mines evolved from that individual scratching at the surface and seeing something interesting. None of them would have succeeded without the partnership of the state in working to protect our resource, but also helping them to advance and to work with them as they work through the federal labyrinth. And this is one place in mining, perhaps in no other places, in an unusual role that the state plays. And I don't know if it's ever been talked about publicly or even written, that in those partnerships that I talked about, where state and federal employees work together, we're able to exert a great deal of influence over our federal partners. We're in the rooms, we're dealing with the issues. We can't direct them, we can't force them, but we can influence them. And probably no more so than in the mining industry do you see that kind of working together and that influence being brought to bear. But it results as a pathway that allows these companies to succeed as opposed to not. And when there's a problem with a federal agency, then we step in and we work with them. We certainly saw that in Pogo, where the permit was challenged by an organization and EPA was forced to review that. We're seeing it right now in Kensington, where the Corps of Engineers was challenged and they pulled their permit back to look at it. You don't see it, but there are DNR employees buried down in the labyrinth of bureaucracy working on a daily basis to help advance those projects, to help influence and to provide such support as we can to allow them to proceed forward. These really are kind of our unsung heroes, because they never get any credit for what they're doing. They derive credit from, at the end of the day, seeing a mine come on. And I think each and every one of us in DNR takes a great deal of pride, and will be standing next to Carl when he pours that first bar of gold. And there will, as I said, there will be no placards to the unsung bureaucratic heroes. There will be no recognition, but there are probably 50 or more state bureaucrats who will be there in spirit, and their spirits will be poured into that first bar of gold. But it is because of what they did we're allowed to proceed. We will do that with Kensington. We will do that with Nixon Fork. We will do that with all of the programs, projects that come forward. We'll get in there, and that's my pledge to you, is that we will get in there and do everything we can to advance these things in a way that is safe. I could go on about mining for hours, because being a geologist, it's one of my many loves. But I will say that for the number crunchers in the state, the mining industry has contributed about $1.6 billion last year to the economy of the state of Alaska. We were able to maintain the billion-dollar mark through the tremendous downturn in metals prices. And the only reason we were able to do that is because of the quality of the resource that we have here. Our future is very, very bright. As we continue working out at Pebble, they just scratched the surface of that deposit. We have no idea how big it's going to be. Donlin Creek is huge, and there are countless other opportunities like that spread across the state of Alaska. And there will be a future for mining in Alaska so long as the people in the state of Alaska embrace miners and look to them as partners. And I hope that that lasts through all of our lifetimes and well into the future. There's a cynical view of the world that says you can't succeed, don't even try. That totally invalidates what bright young engineers, bright young people can bring to bear. I have a huge amount of faith in people to engineer solutions to very tricky environmental problems. It's a zero-sum game, because at the beginning of this exercise you say there will be no degradation, there will be no downturn, there will be no turning your back on the Alaskan environment. But that having been said, let's see if there's a way to be successful and to figure out a way to get it done through the application of technology. That's what's going to see us through these challenges, and that's why I hope that Alaska will always be at the forefront of mining in North America, if not the world. Timber management. DNR has responsibility for all of the timber and state lands throughout. We also have the responsibility for firefighting in coordination with the Bureau of Land Management. Those of you who live in Fairbanks, I don't need to be reminded of the challenges that we face in that regard. This is one area. Tundra travel and firefighting are the two earliest manifestations of the change we seem to be going, or the cycle we're going through in our climate. We are having record, the seasons are shorter, the fire season starts sooner, lasts longer, burns hotter, and is subject to a lot more lightning strikes than it used to be. Our fire management plan has to evolve with the changing fire condition. And Chris Mache, my director of Timber, will work diligently in leading that effort. And Chris is recognized as at the forefront in the nation of being able to manage that urban wildland interface. We will be looking to you for guidance, and we also look to you, of course, for the financial support to do this. But circumstances of the past are not what they are today. And we are going to have to come to grips with this new paradigm. And Chris will lead us in that effort as it comes toward managing the urban wildland interface for fire. Timber industry in Alaska has seen its fair share of challenges in the past, and likely will never go back to the way it was. We have a responsibility in our state lands to do everything we can to manage our resource in a fashion that's appropriate, but also to make the resource available to our timber products industry. We are doing that in a number of ways. One of the ones that I'm most proud of is a program that we have initiated with the Tanana Chiefs and the Fairbanks Economic Development Commission in putting forward an initiative to work together to identify timber resources in the interior and make them available under appropriate conditions to timber industries. Chris tells me that there are a number of people that are now looking at this, and he's had some opportunities to have these folks come forward and work with us. So not only do we fight fires, but we also manage the timber and do so, I believe, in a very good fashion. We've been so successful that the Forest Service is looking to us now to assist them in advancing federal sales. So we will initiate, we're now working on an MOU to work with the Forest Service to assist them in putting up federal timber for sale. This is in its very earliest stages, so I really don't have a lot of detail. And as we engage in this thing, development of this partnership, we'll be looking carefully at what the outcomes are, the roles and responsibilities that we have, and what the end result will be. But it's this willingness to step forward and engage on these issues to try to strike a balance and to assist in our resource development processes, and also in to assist the people of the state who drive their livelihood from resource development that I'm very proud of, that we will continue to do. It does not mean that we will be not successful, that we will engage in every one of these opportunities, because the opportunity has to have a cost-benefit relationship, and we'll look very hard at that. But we're not afraid to look, and we're not afraid to take an action if it makes sense to do that. And I'm sure through the oversight of these two committees and others that we will have an opportunity to propose what we will do and then defend it and hopefully receive your blessing as well. Land sales. Our Division of Mining, Land, and Water is the landlord for all the state's land, as I mentioned earlier. One of our key responsibilities of receiving land from the federal government that we are due to the statehood compact, and then making that land available for municipalities, for private land sales, and determining what should be retained in the state ownership. Building a tax base for our boroughs is very important. It's a sacred duty that we have. They're entitled to this land, and we have a responsibility to take it from the federal government, receive it, process it, and then pass it on. We had probably the only time in my life that I was actually able to participate in a news-breaking event is when we went to Kotzebue, and we provided the municipality, or the borough, Northwest Borough, with over 215,000 acres of land. We made the presentation to the borough assembly, and the local Kotzebue radio station interrupted their normal broadcasting and broadcast the ceremony. So it was a wonderful opportunity to work with the folks in Kotzebue. But it also brought back to home to me again the reason that the DNR does this, is that we're guardians of the land. It's not our job to hold it all, to keep it from anyone else. It's to put the land to work. And what better way to put the land to work is through passing it on to boroughs for their municipal entitlements so that they can build a tax base and they can build an opportunity to generate the resources for their communities. We've had similar successes in the Mat-Su borough. I believe, check my notes here, I think it's about 36,000 acres we just transferred to the Mat-Su borough to all but complete their entitlement. We still have a lot of work to do in on the Arctic slope. That's an area where it's hard to come up with land that is available for selection, but that's one of the things we're going to be taking on with a vengeance here, is trying to figure out a way to resolve that. but certainly the Arctic Slope Borough is entitled to their land, and it's our job to figure out a way to get them to it, or working with the legislature to find an alternative solution. An interesting thing that takes place in Alaska is the ownership of lands beneath navigable waters, lakes and rivers. I can't tell you the challenges we faced in the Senate as we dealt with BLM Wild and Scenic Rivers, where the state of Alaska owned the bed of the river, and the BLM owned the uplands. And of course, we like to encourage our placer miners, and the BLM wasn't too excited about that. So we worked our way through all of that. But that's just a little anecdote to say that we have been filing disclaimers with the federal government for the navigable waters. We've been very successful in getting those to date. We just received disclaimers for 26 rivers and 15 lakes. This simply clears up the title and allows us to proceed. RS-2477 is another area that we work in, and it's been probably one of the most contentious federal issues that's out there. Exerting an RS-2477 is labor-intensive and takes all the grit and determination that we can foster, because these, unlike the rest of the country who has their roads and their trails already in place, we're, in a sense, nation building in Alaska. We're putting in the infrastructure that the rest of the country takes for granted. Our roads are really just dog sled trails that the miners used. They're no less valid, and we are no less entitled to those. If they were wagons had been using them, they're a well-proven road. The burden of proof is very significant, and one of the things that DNR has to do, continue to aggressively pursue the RS-2477s. The governor and certainly the attorney general have indicated a willingness to engage the federal government at all levels to litigate this issue if necessary. But before you litigate it, good old DNR has got to be in there, and they have to develop the record and develop the basis upon which the litigation will be stated. And it's important that we do that. It's kind of a thankless job, but it's also one that's very important as we continue to try to put our infrastructure into place. Parks.
Commissioner, where are we at on that project? Senator or Secretary Gail Norton assured members of this body a couple of years ago before I got here that was an inevitability and it was going to happen with some ease. And I remember being briefed last year and it was on the cusp of happening, and now a year has gone by and we're still doing the same old thing. Can you elaborate, or can you bring up, Dick Miles?
Yeah.
Can you bring Dick up?
Yeah, Dick.
Let's spice things up a little bit, Commissioner. Let's have some turmoil here. Let's get her going. Dick's colorful. Dick, bring us some color.
Dick is also one of our seasoned old combat veterans, so he won't spare any punches.
Representative, can I, excuse me, what was the question again?
Isn't it true, Director Miles, that... no, I just wanted to get a status from you on the RS-2477s. Last year we talked about it. Sounded like we're on the cusp of something happening, and what happened?
Senator and Representative and members of the committees, where we are on RS-2477 is that we did file the quiet title on the two routes, and that basically triggered us to do a lot of research to take to the court. And so at this point we're doing historical research on those two routes to basically document their use, and we've actually hired a historian, or have a historian from State Parks that's doing that work. He's the same person who did the work for the previous RS-2477 quiet title action. And then the other things we've done this year were to hire a firm to actually locate where that trail is. In order to file the RS-2477s, the two probably most important pieces of information are to clearly ascertain where the route is, and then come up with the historical research. So for the that finding the route. We've, like I say, hired engineering and surveying firm to actually get air photos, go out there on the ground, do some reconnaissance. And then the other issue that we've been dealing with is that when you file quiet title on a route like that, you have to file against all property owners. Our goal is to assert the RS-2477 against the federal government, but it turned out I think there were 30 or 40 some other parties that had property interests. And for the last year, we've been largely trying to dismiss those because most of them just, they're like mining claimants, or the part of the route actually passes the Trans-Alaska pipeline. So we've been getting those, kind of settling with those folks. And at this point, there's only three parties that we're still have quiet title against, and those include the owner of a property on Chandelier Lake who's disputing whether or not the route actually goes through his property, the Doyon Corporation who has land selection rights, and then the federal government.
I think that underscores the point I was trying to make, that these are going to be, this is going to be bare knuckles to get these things done, and we've got to just simply dig in and do them and not be dissuaded by the challenges that we face. These will not be easy. They will be very time-consuming, but we just simply have to lay into them and just keep pounding away at it until we will be successful. It's just a question of how much effort we have to put into it, and I think it's worth it.
While Dick's up there, I have another question. You know, maybe a couple of questions. Most of our mining, the modern mining today, the claiming as far as the claims and into production, is being done by companies that are based not in the United States or Alaska, but in Canada. Okay, is that a pretty accurate statement?
Senator, that's correct, that most of the large mine companies are Canadian-based.
I've had several people ask me, what can the state of Alaska do to encourage Alaska companies or other companies located in the United States to be more participatory in our mining programs here in Alaska and our mining ventures? I think I know the question and the answer both, but I thought I'd ask that of you and see what your take on it is.
Senator, my take on it is I think when you get to the large mine companies that actually are needed, you know, that have the capital to build the large mine projects, they tend to be largely Canadian. Worldwide are Canadian, or, you know, there's like South African companies and such, but a large part of the worldwide, the big mine companies are largely not American anymore. And so, that's, I think, the answer is just that there's the big companies are based outside of the U.S. Ed Fogels actually may have more experience with some of the specific companies, though, so he may be able to shed a little more light on that question.
One other question. What, and I apologize because I asked this question last year and got the answer, and I've forgotten the answer. I forgot where I wrote it down. But what revenues do we receive from mines such as the one Donlin Creek? Well, that's not a very good example. Let's say that are on state lands such as the future mine at Pebble, for instance. What revenues would the state of Alaska receive from that project?
Senator, at this point it's hard to tell because we don't know what that project is actually going to look like in terms of size and, you know, how much they're actually going to produce. But the main source of revenue is a royalty, which it's hard to answer the question because we don't really have a lot of experience yet with major mines on state land. Right now, all the major producing mines are not on state land. Pogo is going to be the first one. We don't anticipate getting a lot of revenue the first few years off of Pogo because their capital costs are such that they don't actually start. What we make money off of is what they essentially make as a profit, and they won't show a profit for several years because of the large capital costs for mining. The largest source of revenue for the state is actually through local property taxes paid to, like, Fairbanks North Star Borough. I believe the Fort Knox is the largest taxpayer there. In Northwest Arctic Borough, the Red Dog Mine is the largest taxpayer in the Northwest Arctic Borough. So the biggest revenue actually goes to the local governments in the form of property taxes. And then once we actually get to the point where mines are making a profit, the state does potentially get a fair amount of revenue. But I honestly can't tell you what that's going to be at this point.
Well, we don't need to go into it further here. Maybe you and Ed could make an appointment, come by my office, stop and talk to me a little further on this.
Yes, Senator, I'd be happy to do that.
Thanks.
Well, I've still got you. I'd like to get a follow-up to the lands transfer that we worked on last year and how we're doing with interfacing with the federal government and getting our 250,000 acres from the U.S. feds. That was something that we were going to take up last year. Where are we at on that project here 9 months later?
Representative Ramos, are you referring to the university 250,000 acres,
and the correlating 250,000 acres that Senator Murkowski was going to work on getting from the feds as part of our
on the transfer of the state land of the university, the 250,000 acres that the legislature approved last year? We're working on that for the last since that bill passed, which was as you recall late in the special session. We've been working with the university to kind of work out details of access issues related to specific parcels. We're right now working on an RFP to hire somebody to actually do the title work and draft the deeds and so on. So it's moving along well. We've got, I think, two parcels where kind of have issues over trails and access that we're working out with the university, and in one case with some of the local trail users up in the Mat-Su. So that's moving along well. In terms of the federal university lands bill, there's been no movement on that in Washington. I think the Senator Murkowski just hasn't felt there was support to get that through the U.S. Congress at this point. So there were no hearings held on that federal bill, so there's been no action on that end. In terms of the BLM transfers, BLM has ramped up its land transfer program to the state. The state's received $91 million out of its 105 million acre entitlement, and we have 14 million acres then to go. We recently submitted our revised land selection priorities to the BLM after a year of fairly intensive work with mining folks and oil and gas folks and so on to kind of reevaluate our priorities. And they're going to be approaching that process geographically, starting in the Bristol Bay area, where they're going to try to close out the entitlements for Bristol Bay Native Corporation and the state in that area, and then kind of move around the state. So that program's moving along well, the federal transfer program.
Now, that transfer, they're shooting for a date 2008 to finalize that?
Senator, that was billed as the 2009 program, so that was their goal, but at a meeting that Cam Tui, the special assistant to the Secretary of Interior, about 3 weeks ago was at a meeting, and he said, well, we anticipate it's going to take 4 or 5 years to finish the transfers, and my math says 2006 plus 4 or 5 is greater than 2009. But so I think that deadline slipped a little, but they're still accelerating that program with the hope of closing out those entitlements in the next 4, 5, 6 years.
So there is substantial progress being made.
Yes. Okay. Very much so.
Thank you. Question? Representative Seat.
Thank you, Senator. Yes, I was curious. Senator Wagner brought it up a little bit about the mining tax, and that's a net profit tax, and so it allows the state to miss some revenue there, depending upon how that's structured. And I'm also curious about how prevalent we're anticipating the use of LLCs or sub-S corporations in mines to circumvent the corporate tax structure that we have. In other words, C corporations pay the corporate tax, but if they set up as an LLC or a sub-S, and I know there's at least one in the Cook Inlet area that is planning to do this, then there's no corporate tax paid as well, and I'm just wondering, is DNR's position does DNR have any position on the amount of revenue that the state gets back on the mineral extraction versus the total amount of the $1.6 billion that we're getting?
Yeah, I'll feel that one. The answer to your question is that that would not be a good partnership relationship if they try to circumvent the rules, and I can tell you that we wouldn't just stand by and watch that happening. So it's hard to anticipate how this will play out, but we will watch it very carefully. And if they are not playing by the rules or trying to circumvent, then we will make sure that that stops. There's a lot of work we have to do to get these mines in progress. That partnership is a two-way street, and we expect them to bear their full responsibility.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to imply that they were doing anything wrong. I mean, those are the rules that we've set up, and you know, I can't fault a mine for utilizing the rules that we set up, but I have been in contact with one of the mines in the Cook Inlet area that is planning on using an LLC structure, which is specifically allowed in our law, so that they will not be paying corporate tax on the mine. So anyway, I'm appreciative of the fact that you're not thinking that's a good road to go in a partnership, and so we'll talk further.
Okay, Representative Seaton, thank you for that. Yeah, I believe in fairness, and that is just not right. So we will look at that, and if we identify a problem, we will be back to the resources committees, and we'll lay it on the table, and we'll figure out a way to deal with it jointly. Or if we decide that what's going on is appropriate in consultation with you, then so be it. But it will not go. It will not escape notice.
Thank you. Let's wrap up in about 6 or 8 minutes, then give time for a couple of questions, a couple of more questions.
Let me glance ahead here. The one thing I did want to talk about is parks. Our parks are, for a lot of different reasons, our parks are sort of been suffering from benign neglect. We have over 4 million visitors a year to our park system. And 80% of those visitors are Alaskans. We love our parks. The division has undertaken a process of trying to do some privatization, do some innovative things to relieve the financial burden of managing a park system of this size and magnitude, with a limited amount of success. But frankly, they've kind of lost their way, and our park system is in need of some attention. There are good people managing it. We in the policy level have a responsibility to them to provide them with a guide path. When I was talking to Director Lewinsky about this, he told me that there had not been a strategic plan done for the Alaska Park System since 1971, and that's just unacceptable. When I see the problems that we're dealing with now in the park system and the need to come to you this year and ask for additional funds to provide for the current level of staffing and to deal with some of the tremendous maintenance backlog, I begin to understand why. You cannot leave an agency or a program to drift on its own. It requires attention, and we have a responsibility to provide that attention. So I will be embarking on a program to put together a new strategic plan for our state park system. They are magnificent properties owned by all of the people of the state, and I think the figures suggest that they do use those. We will reach out and bring in people from outside of DNR to assist us in putting together a strategic vision. I will come to you, Senator Wagner and Representative Ramirez, and see if you can provide us with an opportunity for some hearings on this issue, where we can bring people before you to look at it. At the end of the end of this year, I would like to have a brand new strategic plan for Alaska State Parks. Then as you convene next year, there will obviously be some budgetary implications. We'll understand how we got to where we are and what we jointly believe is the appropriate thing to do going forward. But we simply cannot afford to ignore these parks. They become liabilities as opposed to assets, and that's completely unacceptable given the fact that they play such a pivotal role in what we do as Alaskans in recreation during the summer. I'll close with the Department of Agriculture. The Division of Agriculture. It is another division that has a diminishing constituency, those who directly participate in the process. You are all familiar with the history of agriculture in the state of Alaska, going back to the settlement in the Matsu Borough, to the Delta Barley Farms, to the dairy farms. All of this has not been without its share of controversy. One of the things that we need to do, that I need to do with your oversight and blessing, is to take a look at the division, take a look at the programs that they provide, and to assist in building, strengthening that division, making it what we want it to be. The people that are affected by the activities of the division are a very small minority, and they do not deserve to be lost in the shuffle of gas pipelines and borough entitlements and new mega mines. These are flesh and blood people, and I feel a personal responsibility as your designated commissioner to try to assist in crafting a future that has them in it, where they have a voice, and where the role the DNR plays supports both them and supports the goals of the state and the expectations that we all have. Agriculture is not something that should just go away. If the climate continues to modify like it is, Alaska could be the new corn belt of the U.S. I say that with a little bit of a smile, but we have a huge amount of agricultural base land out there that we can put to productive use. I think our pioneers in the ag business have demonstrated our ability to move products, our seed potatoes to China, blueberries, incredible source of antioxidants, our northern blueberries. So there's real potential and real opportunity there, and we have to join together to reshape the destiny of that division. And I will look to you for your guidance and for your thoughts on that issue. The governor has asked me to figure out a way to get this patient off of life support and get it back into making a real contribution, which they want to do, to Alaska. So I'll leave it with that. There's some challenges there, but we will take them on head on. And I will be reporting to you the progress that I've made in proposals, policy proposals that we're putting together, and I'll certainly run them by you for your thoughts. I think with that, I will stop, throw it open to questions. I've covered DNR at not even 50,000 feet, it's 100,000 feet. It's an agency that reaches into everybody's lives and touches them on a very personal level. And I'm proud to be associated with it, and look forward to the opportunity to serve the people of Alaska and to provide you with the information you need as you exercise your responsibilities to the electorate. So thank you, and we stand ready collectively to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Crawford. Mark, you're
welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't disagree with anything that you've said so far. You know, all the issues that you've brought up are important to the future of Alaska. One thing I didn't hear mentioned is something that Alaska has a huge potential in, and that's the field of alternative energy and renewable energy. We're one of the major energy producers around the world, but we may have already peaked out on the amount of oil that we produce or ever will produce. I expect that Alaska will continue producing oil for another 50 years or maybe 100 years, but we have huge resources in wind and water and geothermal, and there are new technologies that are being developed to change that electricity into hydrogen that we can ship in tankers around the world. And I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said, if you want to predict the future, go create it. And I'd like to be part of that future. I want to be in the forefront of where the world is going to, instead of just where the world is today. And I'd like for you to focus on that part of Alaska's natural resources as well.
Representative Crawford, thank you for bringing that up. And we are working in that area, and it is only because of the time constraints that I didn't delve into that. We have a lot of activity going on, working closely with Bernie Carl on low-temperature geothermal up at Chena Hot Springs. We're also working with folks out on the Aleutians with both the McCushion and on Alaska. So there's tremendous geothermal resources out there, real high temperature geothermal resources out there. And anyone that comes forward with a plan will be embraced, but short of that plan, we're also doing what we can to encourage those resources, because I agree with you, those high temperature geothermals are amazing and should be in a energy starved world. There's got to be a niche for that geothermal resource up there, and we will continue trying to find what it is. You mentioned hydrogen, and one of the things that we're working on now is our methane hydrates, because there's a tremendous amount of methane hydrate on the North Slope, and it appears from early analysis that a significant amount of that, as much as 33 trillion cubic feet, may be producible using conventional technology. So that would be a huge resource, and even though it's not renewable, it's almost renewable because of the volume of it. And you're right, that resource will bridge the gap into the hydrogen economy, and there's nothing better for the hydrogen feedstock than methane. So it's the perfect fuel to create hydrogen to deal with that. The other issues you're talking about, wind, I was just up in Kotzebue about 6 weeks ago and went out and visited with great pride their growing wind farm out there as they come to grips with harnessing that resource. It's an amazing thing. It's like, it's so good, it's almost bad. Because of the density of our cold air here, the technology necessary to deal with wind capture in Alaska presents tremendous engineering challenges. But the folks up there in Kotzebue are at the forefront of that technology. If they can nail that down, then that technology spreads. So our wind resources are literally limitless. So these are things we're very interested in. They are at the margins of what we're doing, and I'd love to visit with you if there are any ideas you would have to strengthen some of these areas. It's significant interest to us.
Two words, fire out.
Well, I want to give you on the record your question. So Representative Newman has a question or two. Come up here so we can get on the record with you, or over there.
Thank you, Chair Wagner. Commissioner Mange, could you please explain and hopefully add a little bit of assurances to the many user groups that do add tens of millions of dollars to the economies across the state, including farmers from Homer to Valdez, including farmers that are hay farmers, dairy farmers, the Delta barley farmers, feed mills, of course, are all our kids who raise 4-H projects. They all depend on a USDA certified packaging plant. Can you tell us that there will be a smooth transition of Mount McKinley meat and sausage into private hands, which is supported by these user groups?
Representative, I have brought two of my staff specifically down from Anchorage to visit with you tomorrow or when your schedule allows to go over the plan that we committed to you that we were going to do when we visited you with the Valley. So Rachel and Ed will both be sitting down with you, and we will craft a solution to that problem together.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I want to ask one question, then give Senator Seaton a chance for a question. Then we had a break because we had to get this room ready for a presentation at 3. So there's a bill in the Senate currently, I think it's Gretchen Guest's bill, on one-stop shopping for permitting. Have you looked at that bill, or have your people looked at that bill, and if they have, what do they think of the bill? And
Senator Wagner, I have not personally looked at the bill, nor have I asked staff to review it at this point. It's an important concept, and we will look at it. I've always been a big advocate of one-stop shopping, but we have to be careful if the view of one-stop shopping is to delegate authority of a variety of agencies into one individual. It would be important to take a very hard look at that. So it will depend on how the bill presents the one-stop shopping, but it's a very important concept and one that we will look at very carefully.
Senator Seaton, I'm a Representative Seaton. I keep promoting this guy.
I don't know.
First, Gary Stevens.
thank you. The question I had was on the Farm Service Agency is planning on closing two offices, one in Homer and one in Wasilla. Currently, the Homer office serves everything from Prince William Sound, Homer, Kodiak, out the Aleutian chain, and up to Nome. And, you know, the farmers that are serviced by the those offices are very concerned that centralizing something into Anchorage, which is not going to have any personal contact other than, you know, somebody coming around like advertising in the paper, come see us like the Social Security our administration does, is not going to be effective. Has DNR, Agriculture, commented and worked with the U.S. Agriculture Department to try and keep those open?
I am not aware of anything specific. I will check into that and get back to you personally. I'm not aware that there were office closings proposed, so we're going to have to do our homework on that, but I will get back to you. I understand the importance of having that community contact, so let's just say that will certainly be where we're coming from, and as I get the information, I will provide that to you.
Any other questions? Not, we're going to conclude the meeting right now. Thank you very much, Commissioner, and thank your staff.
Thank you, Senator.
And just so we get it on the record, we were just joined by Senator Elton.